Hello, and welcome to today's IRI Sustainability Thought Leader interview with Jeff Strahan.
Jeff is Director of Research, Compliance, and Sustainability at Milliken & Company, and this interview is an element of IRI's sustainability community. Okay, so Jeff, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a bit about your background and about Milliken?
Sure. So I grew up around the U.S. I did my undergraduate at Gonzaga University in chemistry and then PhD at Texas in organic chemistry. Milliken was my first real job. I started off as an R&D chemist and then bounced around a variety of roles across the company at the corporate level and then within business units and division levels. Every company has their own hierarchy, right? But just bouncing around. And so now I have, as you said, responsibility for research and development, compliance, and sustainability for our textile division. Milliken as a whole, we're privately held. We're coming up on 160-year-old, which is really cool. We have four divisions: textile, that's our biggest and oldest, chemical, floor covering, and healthcare. Variety of projects, lots of business-to-business stuff. You probably touch a lot of stuff with our products in it that you don't know about, but that's the whole. And you know, go to the website, see all the fancy pictures if you need more details.
Awesome. All right. So let's just dive right into the whole PFAS thing. So when did you first realize that PFAS were going to be a problem for Milliken?
Yeah, the grammar of PFAS has not been, dictated from I guess. So I'll put it, for me personally, was in 2019. I remember, at that point in time, right, kid was down. Now we have more than one, but watching Netflix with my wife. And I just moved into compliance and one pops up, the devil that we know. You're like, oh boy, right? Like, what's this, right? And it's a really compelling story, right? It's a documentary about PFOA, PFOS, right? And wastewater and DuPont and that whole world. And you watched it, right? And it's pretty sensationalized. But nonetheless, it's a compelling story, right? And then that led to a full-length movie called Dark Waters, essentially covering the same topics, more or less. Again, very compelling story. And I remember watching The Devil That We Know, and you're like, oh, this is going to catch fire. Right. Like virally, like this is going to get a lot of press, whether it was true or not, or 75% was true, or, it didn't matter. Right. Like it was a well done document. So I watched that. I saw it coming. And then I swear it was like in 3 months, politicians got a hold of it. And the science went from PFOA is bad and PFOS is bad. Right. Like these two bad actors. And if you even read some of the EPA language to this day, they're very soft on what they say, right? Some PFAS might be linked to health, right? I mean, there's a lot of qualifiers in what they're stating. Like, this is not the Surgeon General warning on the pack of cigarettes, right? Where it's like, yes, smoking causes lung cancer, right? Like, there's some maybes and mights and coulds and stuff like that. But then I think COVID had happened in this point in time, because I remember watching it virtually from home. So February, March 2020, some CNBC something, or, I don't remember which politician, but then it was PFAS causes cancer. Right. And there was this huge jump from, I thought we were talking about two and maybe and could, and then all of them do, right? And it was such a jump. And that's when you knew, it was like, this isn't about science anymore, right? This is just being controlled by the press and by politicians, both sides, right? So, and that's what's happened. And it's oversimplified, it's overstated. Two examples that I like to bring up: Prozac, right? Been on the market since the mid 80s. That's a PFAS. It has a CF3 group. And so by current definitions, that one not only doesn't cause cancer, it actually has known health benefits, right? Paxlovid, the new COVID treatment, has the CF3 group on it, right? And they just approved that. So you're sitting there like, yeah, come on, like try to, don't make this so simple. But nonetheless, that's how I'd answer the question, is probably 2019, 2020-ish when politicians got a hold and they oversimplified and overstated, and here we are.
Yeah, here we are indeed. So what are the regulations that are actually impacting milk and as you see them right now?
Yeah, so I think it's important to take a step back, right? And so, you know, I'm in finishing high school and in undergrad, and the EPA tells all U.S. people, stop using these long chain C8s, okay? And there's a voluntary program, and a lot of people like sign up, and they actually hit it ahead of target. And during that time, the EPA actually tells everyone, go use C6, right? Stop using long chain C8. Those are the bad ones. Go use C6. And so the whole industry switches to C6. And 20 years later, they're now changing their tune, and now they're saying, no, you can't use any of it. So it's kind of things, and I understand science changes and things get updated, but I think it's important to kind of have that history of the federal government told people to use C6 because it was safe, right? Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, you can't use it. You should have known it was bad. And you're like, you told me it was safe, right? Nonetheless, the ones that are hitting us now, like personally through Millikan directly, are all through water. Water permits of our manufacturing sites. So this public news in 2021, around Thanksgiving, came back from Turkey Day, had an email from the EPA in my inbox that said, you have 60 days to give us all this information. And they wanted to know what PFAS you used, when, where, why, how much, et cetera, et cetera. That went to 8 other textile manufacturers. Again, all public news. And they compiled all that. And Millikan is a member of NCTO, the National Council of Textile Organizations. They have met with the EPA Office of Water. And we are expecting in 2024, the EPA Office of Water is going to go to every textile manufacturer in the U.S. and ask for all of that information all the way back to 2011, which is going to be quite an ask. You know, it's a long time ago, right? And Millikan's been on SAP for a while now, but not since 2011. So like, I don't even know if we'd be able to answer some of those questions, right, as accurately as we can now. So we're seeing it at the state levels where there's not a particular limit yet, but it is now when you grab your sample and go test for pH and solids and, right, BOD and COD and normal water permit things. Go test for PFAS and tell us the amount. No limit yet, but they're starting to collect all the data. So those are the ones that are directly hitting us. And I think that's really how they're going to hit everyone on the phone first, is through industrial permits. A lot is happening through the marketplace, right? In terms of our customers and what states are demanding in terms of products that we don't sell directly into those states, but, you know, it's those are our customers, or maybe our customer's customer that's hitting us. So we'll kind of get into that a little later, but those are the ones that are directly hitting us.
All right. So it sounds like you were pretty early on with all this. So how did you get leadership on board with all the changes you knew were going to be necessary?
Right. You know, I didn't know anything about this in 2018. Right. I mean, I knew we used fluorinated chemicals to do certain things on certain textiles. So I'd say the first thing is, you know, you just have to humbly approach a new subject. Right. There's a lot of smart people in the world, a lot of smart people at IRI. And so you just, you know, pick up books and ask questions and go talk to them, and don't be afraid if you. I mean, I called authors of papers. Right. And it was just like, I don't understand this. Like, or. Here's 10 facts. Are those right? But like, here's what I think I know. Is this right? You know, and I'd have people like, you got 9 right, but number 10 is actually this, right? And so, okay, right. You just learn. And I'd also say, have a pretty open, you know, window as to who you're listening to, right? I think it's important to listen to, you know, those that make PFAS, right? And those that are totally against it, right? And like, what's their reasoning, and whether you agree with it or not, right? Just to understand, this is the argument that they are making. One for me that was personally enlightening, I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not a marine biologist, right? I'm an organic chemist. And you would read some of these exposure papers, and it was like, migs per kg was a lot of dosing. And you're like, okay, I kind of know what that means. And then you back calculate, and you're like, I'd have to drink a swimming pool of water to get, you know, hurt by this stuff. Like, what's wrong? So I called a toxicologist. Lo and behold, they don't do studies on humans with this stuff. They do it with mice. And the half-life in humans is almost, you know, 3 years, right? But in a rat, it's way, way less. And so they have to feed the rat so much to get their blood concentration up for where it would be for us, because our half-life is so long in us. So, I mean, it was just like one of those, oh, I didn't know that equation. And here's the equation that all the toxicologists use. So, you know, and eventually you become a subject matter expert, right? After you've been doing that for 3 years, like I have. And so how do you convince them is, you know, you have to convince yourself that you know what's going on, and then being able to communicate that, and many meetings at many levels. And I just say we ultimately made the decision, right, to leave for the textile division. You know, ultimately, right, it was the right thing to do, right? It's consistent with our values, right? And even though the EPA language is pretty soft, right, if the EPA is coming out and saying, hey, these things might have some health effects, like, okay, like, we'll back away from that table, right? Some of our customers were already demanding it. Polar Tech is a Millikan brand. They were out even before the rest of the textile division was out. They had been demanding it for a while. So some of it was just, you know, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, customer, we'll do that for you. And then some of it's just the regulations, right? And I think this is important, at least, especially in the textile division. Our supply chains are really long, right? It takes a while to do all the material handling, right? I mean, dig up oil, right? And make polyester and make a fiber and then spin it and then weave it and then cut it and then goes on a shelf and then somebody's got to sell it. And so California is passed a law, and I think theirs is going to basically be the blueprint for a lot of other states. And overall, the tagline to it, at least for textiles, is no PFAS on textiles in 2025. And so you start to do your supply chain, right? And stuff that Millikan is making now that, you know, we sell to Carhartt, we sell to Dickies, right? It probably takes that long to get around the block, right? To go be a shirt on Walmart shelf, right? And so, you know, we got some pushback from some customers. You're so early. And you're like, let's draw the Gantt chart out here, folks. And, you know, for us, for you to be out by 2025, I need to be out, right, well before then. And I need to be out and already have that product replaced. And you need to be confident. And we need to go through all the R&D and development and verification and validation and et cetera, et cetera. So I think looking back, if anything, okay, maybe we were 6 months early, but by all means, I mean, we're just trying to be responsive to the regulations as is. And so that was an easier story to tell, right, to the business-minded folks.
Mm. And so that's the leadership. What about the rest of the organization? All of your colleagues and peers?
Yeah, so there were quite a few R&D directors of other businesses that I talked to, and I was like, yeah, I'm about to swamp you with about 50 different projects, right? Because you need to go replace all of these. So, but once you explain it, right, and went through it, okay, you know, they got it. The big focus was on sales, right? And the people that are really out on the front lines that are going to have to tell the customer, hey, you, if you want this, we're not making this anymore. And so we did FAQs. We did, you know, things to say, things to not say. One big one that I pushed was you can't say PFAS free because there's PFOA in basically all water everywhere. And the testing limits are so low, and we use water from the river to process our textiles. So I don't know if there's parts per trillion PFOA on any textile that Millikan makes. I didn't put it there. If it is there, it's not doing anything at that level on purpose. But this world is so litigious, right, that free can be a loaded legal term. And so, you know, we non-PFAS or non-intentionally added is the language that we've used. So we did a lot of training, a lot of webinars, internal, external, I've given talks like this on several outlets and at conferences and to news outlets, et cetera. So we try to get our message out.
All right. So how's this impacted your R&D functions?
Sure. So, you know, if you take a step back, fluorine affects surfaces is if you had to draw one big circle around it. And for the textile world, it really does three things. It repels water, things called DWRs. There's a lot of non-PFAS DWRs already out in the world. So those were a lot of go-do projects. So it might be a large number of projects, but in terms of technical difficulty, the answer was on the shelf somewhere. You just had to go find it. And what we learned was, you know, it's not like there was ever just one jar of PFAS and all textile manufacturers just put it on in one certain way that did everything for everyone, right? I mean, there's already a level of granularity below that. And then what we learned is that when you replace it for DWRs, it's even more complicated, right? And so certain color, a polyester black knit might get a different DWR than a blue polyester woven, right? Just depending on this one's in the jet and this is a pad and this is, you know, coated a particular way or foamed on or whatever it is. So a lot of projects, but some go-dos there. No real invention per se required. The next thing that fluorine does is soil release. So this is, I use the example of sitting on the greasy fry, right? So that you're not repelling the oil. You have, you know, sat on the fry and the grease is going into your textile. So if you wash it, does it get rid of it? And then Millikan, we were originally the inventors of that technologies back in the 60s and 70s and came up with that whole test method. And up and down our halls were the inventors of that technology, which is really cool. And so that industry went to PFAS because it did a good job. And so now we got to get out of it. And so this was a huge R&D project. We've been working on it since 2019. A lot of key technical inventors that we put on it. And this literally went from round bottom flask to full scale production over a few years. So now that's commercial. And, you know, hoorah, rah, score one for the nerds. Right. We were really happy with that. And so that's out. The third thing that fluorine does for textiles is repel oil. No one has cracked that nut yet. It's really difficult. And I like to tell people, you know, I'm a chemist, but if you go to our chemical division, their COA, right, their spec sheet is 5 lines long, 10 lines long, right? You go to a textile spec sheet, it's going to be 50 lines long, right, mm-hmm. In terms of what it is, right? You are cotton. You weigh this much. Here's your construction, right? Here's your blend, air mids, da da da. And then there's what it does, right? And it can't shrink. It can't burn. You got to wash it, and it's got to stay the same color. It doesn't, you know, tons and tons of stuff there. And so you might be able to make a textile that can repel oil, but you can't touch it, and you can't wash it, and it can't be green, and you can't do it on cotton, and you can't, right? And so it's a really tough problem. So we're working on it. We're looking, talking to startups, talking to a bunch of different companies, and, you know, whoever gets there, they solved a really tough problem, and good for them. So ultimately, you know, from a business point of view, we had to leave business that because we couldn't meet those specs. And we'd go to the customer and say, can you please change that spec? Right. But sometimes the answer was no. And so we agreed to disagree and had to leave that business.
Wow, that must have been really tough.
Not the message that people wanted to get to, but, you know, it's where your values and the rubber meets the road, right? In terms of, okay, if we're going to do this, this is what this means. So we had the backing of leadership to do that. And so we did.
I want to come back to that, the whole relationship with your customers. But first, I want to make sure that, you know, while we're talking about R&D, we cover the analytical techniques that you're using and how you decided which ones to go with.
Yeah, so this was another learning opportunity for me and the team. And so from a high level, there's three buckets to detect fluorine. One is neutron activation. So this is pretty cool. There's a beam up in Canada that can do this, and you blast it with neutrons and it goes through these nuclear decay things that are really cool. And eventually, hey, here's your PPM. It's about 2 PPM is the limit, but there's no sample prep, which is key. Like, you can literally put whatever in this glass jar and they can go testing.
Cool.
Yeah, it's nice, right? And it's important when you compare it to the other two. So the other two, the second one is CIC, or combustion ion chromatography, well-known technique, right? You combust stuff, you make everything, salt that's soluble in water. So it's going to turn the PFAS to fluoride. And then I'm going to go measure that fluoride, right, via ion chromatography. So that technique is awesome, right? So 50 ppb detection is the most common number you'll hear. But there's no sample prep listed in any test method, because it's normally done on water, right? So you got to get it to the water. So if I hand, right, a piece of textile to a combustion ion chromatography person, they're going to go, well, what the hell you want me to do with this? Right? Like, do I combust the whole textile? Do I extract it? What do I extract it with? For how long? What pH? What temperature? Right? And all the analytical nerds, right, are just variable, 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 right, that I need to validate my method. So cool technique, known technique, but there's still a big gap, right, in that sample prep that's yet to be standardized across the industry. And then the last one is like the super cool mass spec, QTOF, mass spec, MS, mass, you know, all the acronyms that analytical people throw at you. But so it's down to PPT. Kind of depends on what method I've heard, 4, 5, 10, 20, you know, but in that range, right? Limited detection. But there's no sample prep, again, given. And it only tests for like known standards. So the EPA method, which is what they'll tell you to use, I think it's either 32 or 41. I can't remember the number. Specific molecules, right? PFOA, PFOS, PFHXA, PF, right? So it's just very, very known things. Combustion ion chromatography, if it's got fluoride on it, it's not going to know if it's Teflon polymer or PFOA, because it's going to combust that and make fluoride, and you won't be able to trace it back to, well, what was it, right? Versus the mass spec method that does know that. But there, again, there's no extraction method. They're used to dealing it with wastewater samples. So we know these things now. We know the labs that do them and how much they cost. So we've used neutron scattering the most, just because it's easy, and they can test water, they can test the textile, they can test a finish, whatever it is. So that's what we use now.
Okay. All right. So let's get back to the customer situation. So have you been communicating this to them? And as you say, you've had to walk away from some business. That's hard.
Yeah, it is. So we made a press release. February is Valentine's Day of 22. That's right. Gotta get my years right. And said we will be out January 1, 2023. We had already done some pre-work before then. So if anyone was shocked, they had 10 months to get over the shock, right? And we did that on purpose, right? So that we could build in that R&D timeline, right? And then, you get on a lot of webinars, you get on a lot of planes, and this was tough during COVID. So a lot of calls, and explain your case, right? And hey, here's, and again, you got to be humble about it. I'm not a toxicologist, but here's what the EPA is saying, right? Here are the laws that are being passed, right? And so I didn't go to law school, but, you know, I've been given an honorary law degree from our legal department in terms of, you know, breaking it down. And so you really, you know, when I just go into the details of the law, the key thing I emphasize is patchwork. Right. So a great resource, saferstates.org. They do a pretty good job of trying to keep up with this stuff. And I don't know that it's always, as soon as I say a number, it'll be out to date. Right. But there's something like, yeah, right, over 120 laws already on the books in 20 something states, because PFAS does so many different things to so many different industries. Right. One state might have a firefighting foam regulation on the books right now, and then the textile one is next year, and then the film packaging one is next year, and the food contact one is 6 months before that, but only for burgers, but not for hot dogs, right? And it's just crazy detailed. And then right next to the other state, they already have the textile one, but the firefighting foam is next year, right? And so it's just, imagine driving a truck, right? You know, you're going to cross seven jurisdictions with 27 different rules. And then California's got the big scary one in 2025. Maine has one that I still think is a little overambitious, but you know, the tagline was no PFAS in the state in 2030, period. Right. And so you're sitting there like, okay, so no Prozac in the state? Right.
That's not going to go well. No.
It's not going to go well for some people. Right. And then what about, you know, some of these fluoropolymers you use for EVs? So I thought the world wanted EVs. Right. And some PFAS are used to make chips. I thought we all wanted more chips. We are already low on cars because we didn't have enough to write. So that it just, the definition gets people in a boatload of bad places quickly. So explaining that. Right. And then finally, and I know there's a question later about this, but ultimately it's going to be illegal. Right. Like they're going to regulate this out through wastewater permits. So some of our customers, industrial launderers, have wastewater permits at their sites. And so it's like, look, they're hitting us with these wastewater permits and you're next. And the limits that they're talking about are so low that essentially you can't allow any in your plant at all. So you tie these in the tie and you don't, it's not a 5-minute conversation. And sometimes you'll explain it to one person and, hey, tell that to my boss, right? I need to get my boss's boss on the phone. They need to hear this. My lawyers want to hear this. Our regulatory, our environmental wants to hear this. So it took time, but I think it was worth it. And another aspect of it is we had to be specific of, I'm not telling you to change every single specification of every single product. I'm talking about this line, right? The color is still going to be the same. The stretch is still going to be the same. It's still going to do X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, E. It just can't do G anymore, right? And so some customers were okay with that and some weren't. So it was a long process, but it's part of the game these days.
So how has, all right, let's take a step back. So how about the PFAS supply chain?
Yeah.
And how has that worked for you? You're going back all the way.
Yeah. So it's, you know, there's a couple of big scary numbers out there. So 3M just signed a north of $10 billion settlement. That's an enormous, enormous number for them, I'm sure. And for companies smaller than them would be the death of them. Right. And DuPont, Chemours, right, in that corporate history, I think they've signed a $1.4 billion agreement, right? All this public news, you can go Google it. And so out of that, right, 3M in January of 2023 announced they're out, right? And so you're looking at one of the historic, I got a lot of respect for 3M. I have a lot of peers that work for 3M, right? I think they're a great company. They invented some of this stuff, and so they know it the most. They've essentially said, I'm out by 2025. So even if you wanted to use it, who's going to make it for you? That's not clear, which was another message to tell to our customers of, even if you wanted it, and even if I could make it from you, I can't order that stuff anymore, right? And then as soon as 3M filed that, I think like 2 weeks later, an NGO on the green side of things petitioned Congress. But now you get into like the EPA regulatory world, and they basically said, I want to snur everything that 3M makes. So, which basically means as soon as 3M stops making it, no one else can make it. And if you make it, you have to tell the government again, and they're basically going to say, no, you can't make it. So like now it's not even going to be allowed in the country. Right. And it's kind of sad because, you know, the U.S. were not perfect. Right. But we have an EPA and permits and a system. And so if you wanted PFAS made in the world, where would you want it made? Probably want it made in the U.S. Right. Where we're really on top of things and not other jurisdictions that have, you know, more lax and questionable environmental policies. So be careful what you wish for there. But nonetheless, you know, that's what's happening, right? Is I think people can see the writing on the wall again. Like 3M got sued on average 3 times a day for an entire year for this stuff, right? I mean, it's just, I wouldn't even know how to comprehend if you're working on this at either one of those companies. And so you know, those lawsuits are now being done up and down the chain. So people can see the writing on the wall. And I think a lot of people are going to exit. And we've seen that since we've announced, other people and other brands have announced. There's a Boston website that does a pretty good job of tracking all the companies that say I'm out. And there's, you know, Amazon's and Home Depot's and, you know, some really big, big brands on the food side, on the apparel side, kind of all over industry. So we feel like we timed it right.
Hmm. So you removed PFAS as much as you could possibly right. do as of the end of last year. How's it going?
Yeah, so we did it, right? So that was cool. A major project, a lot of people involved, and you know, we hit our milestones and we had lots of meetings in December, right? Myself, my team went to all the finishing plants, like, where's the last bucket of it, right? Like, you know, we're going to stop. And so now I think you have to kind of turn on your SAP digital or Oracle, right? Whatever software you're using, and you got to kind of make sure it's physically gone and digitally gone. So, you know, do you make new product numbers for all of the non-PFAS stuff?
Oh, gosh.
Right.
Sounds like an admin nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of work, right? And so some businesses said yes, some businesses no. Do any of those products need to be recertified, right, from a third party? Or is it all just internal testing, or is there some customer testing that they need to do? So that was a decision. And then, you know, we're really tracking our inventory, right, to zero. So we stopped making it, but our shelves weren't clean, right, at that point in time. And so now for a while there, we're doing it every other week. Now we're down to once a month. We pull that report, right? How many yards, how many dollars, by what business, what customers are going to order it, when, you know, and the chart is going down. No one knows if we're in a recession or not. So orders are noisy right now. So we think we'll probably be out Q3, Q4, right? Some businesses already are, some aren't, right? It just depends on orders and whatnot. But on January 1, we weren't done, certainly, right? It was a lot of tracking and then, you know, the customer communication of, hey, this is the last roll with that stuff on it. And then what do you do with retains, right? What do you do with, if a customer says, you know, they want to ship it back, we told everyone, no, we don't even want it in our plants. So there was a lot of checklists, right? And, you know, our plants are running 24/7, right? So you got to communicate plant manager and your process engineers and your people on the line. And, you know, you just want several layers of redundancy built into your system so that no one could even order it, right? You got to work with sourcing. Hey, just delete this. You can never order this again, right? And then delete every material that ever used it, that no one can ever place that order. So if a sales guy like fat finger or something, it can't even get in the system, right? I mean, there's just that level of detail that you have to think through. So we're near the end of that, but it was a lot of work. People are still working on it.
Well, that's awesome. It sounds like a great goal, and you know, the team was all on board, so that made things easier.
We're at Millikan, if we set a goal, people want to get an A on the test. So there's definitely some corporate culture that helped us.
Awesome. All right. So now's when we open the floor to questions. And I'm sure there are going to be a ton. So you can either put them in the chat, or I encourage you to raise your hand so you can have a conversation with Jeff. But let's see who wants to be first in the hot seat.
Hi, Jeff. That was a great presentation. Thank you very much. My name is Arvind. I'm from Owens Corning. This is the first time I'm attending this. So it's a great talk. Thank you for keeping us engaged.
My pleasure.
I definitely lived through what you have been living through in the past 3 years in my company and in my role. On top of everything that you said, I agree and I do recognize and realize. There's also one aspect where there is an expectation from the market that I want this PFAS-free solution at the same price or even reduced price.
Yeah.
So that I can not only take it from you, but also use the sustainability angle towards whatever I'm trying to do from my sustainability goals. How was it difficult? Because this non-PFAS solutions were not always, in my opinion, landing on the same comparable cost to you or price to the market.
Right. No, you're right. You know, some of them were cost parity. Some of them were definitely more. Some were the chemical was the same, but your processing speeds are different. And so that's going to fall out in your cost, right? Line speed or run hotter, or, you know, run slower, et cetera. I'd almost say there's probably the classic answer. It depends, right? Just, you know, going to that customer and how specified was it, right? I mean, our non-PFAS soil release, like, hey, that's a big invention, big investment at R&D. We're actually seeing better performance than the PFAS stuff. And so I've got a story to tell there, right? Just in terms of I've got a new solution that's better. Let's just disregard the PFAS aspect of things, right? Do you want this? It's gives you better soil release numbers and it's more durable. There were others who, some honestly were just, oh, it's a DWR, just move on, right? Like they didn't even want to know when you switched. They didn't need any, you know, new testing, et cetera, et cetera. So you're right, there is. And then the sustainability side, you know, I think, again, you try to choose your words carefully of, you know, I don't know what it means for something to be sustainable. But I can tell you, I know what it means for something to be more sustainable, right? And and non-PFAS stuff is better, right? But some of them, right, they're acrylates and you got to make, you know, use acrylic chloride, right? And, you know, that has its own issues, right? Not the longevity for every chemical label, but, you know, it's still an acid chloride, right? And you got to be careful around those things. So don't know if I answered your question, but yes, very valid point. Thanks for breaking the ice there.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Arvin. And I think, Felix, you wanted to ask a question too.
Yes, thanks, Jeff. So this discussion reminds me of the whole kind of BPA argument. They replace it with BPA, then discover that, yeah, it's BPA-free, but whatever they replace it with is about the same, has the same sort of effect, right? It's not really helping anything. So how do you know that whatever you're replacing PFAS with, are you doing any kind of health studies to figure out that,
right,
20 years on the line they're not going to do the same thing again?
Yeah, classic question there. If I had an accurate crystal ball that could predict 20 years from now, I would not be on an IRI webinar. I would, you know, be sipping, you know, some fine beer in southern France. But I think towards that, what the language that we've used is, we don't see any regulatory or supply chain issues that we see with PFAS, right? And I could point to Safer States or Chemical Watch, right? And there's 150 state bills right now all on PFAS. And what I replaced it with? Zero. So I can't predict 20 years from now, but I can just tell you, you know, as I look at the landscape, I don't see that regulatory pressure. You know, you do rely on your suppliers, right? Are your SDSs up to date, right? I mean, you know, if anyone wants to lie, cheat, or steal, there's always a way around the system. So there's got to be trust within the industry. And sure. So we expect those things that they went through. And the EPA, I mean, I think any chemical manufacturer right now, they are so slow on PMNs right now. It's taken forever to make a new molecule. There's so much pressure. So they're not allowing a lot of new stuff through. So in theory, it was stuff that was already on the shelf, right? Maybe reformulated. But great question. And I don't have a 20-year answer, but I've got a 5-year answer that says, no, we're good.
So there's no health study, toxicology study for these classes of things that Milliken is kind of looking into? I mean, that's a very open-ended question, right? So maybe it's too big.
Yeah, it's like, that's not, we're not going to fund those toxicology studies. Like, isn't that what the EPA is for? And the companies who do make them, right? Like, that's, you made it. There's a legal, you know, system to make those chemicals. So we assume the system has worked upstream. We're always open for new news, right? But we're assuming that, you know, the EPA has already seen the stuff and said, okay, yes, you're fine.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Felix.
Right, the next question is from Tim Turner from Church & Dwight. He's asking, based on your PFAS experience, what are the key principles that you would apply to impact assessments for future regulatory changes?
Ooh, that's a good one. Okay, so I'm going to kind of restate the question out loud to make sure I understood it. So, you know, kind of not related to PFAS, but like, you know, if there's another one, what key principles would I take, right, to apply? Okay, thanks, Tim.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we work for private industry. So the first thing you're going to think is, okay, how much revenue is at risk? Right. And so when we've talked to other, I'll just back up the train, right? So in 2019, there wasn't a report anywhere in the company or in the division or within a business unit that said, this is how much revenue PFAS touches. We didn't know because it wasn't a thing, right? Like we didn't know we had to filter that and pivot table, right? And get to an answer. So I think the first thing is like having that data set so that you can get there if you needed to, right? And what'll happen to us now is, you know, especially in the textile world, a new dye will get labeled bad, right? Purple 27-9er, right? Or whatever the color is, right? And so you need a system that, okay, do I have any purple 27-9er, right? And then, you know, what products is purple 27-9er touching such that I can go to those customers and find out, does the regulation apply to them in that industry? So I think it's almost just like a quality data issue that you kind of need to think through first. Like that's where I would go first is, do I have the scaffolding to put in a quote unquote bad chemical to know its effects? And then you got to go to your, depending on the hazard, let's say it is another, you know, aqueous water-based one that's an issue. Okay, what do your wastewater treatment plants do, right? Is there a good test, right? What are the analytical methods that you would even go do to find out where it is or isn't and convince yourself that it's there? So I'm a nerd, so that's where I'm going to go, right? Is just let's make sure the data is good and your analytical techniques are up to snuff when it does come out.
Thank you.
Hope that helped. Thanks, Tim.
All right. I think we've got time for one more if anyone wants to jump in here. Oh, Lauren, go for it.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I was curious what definition your company decided on internally for defining PFAS in light of the broad variety, particularly EPA sort of settling on a C2 model versus states looking at C1 centered definitions.
Yeah, so we went with, and it's changed. So, you know, you're right. Right. Who are you going to say? But we've gone with, you know, for the textile division, right? Any carbon with two or more fluorines on it.
Gotcha.
That's what we've just gone with. And it, yes, it is broad. And yes, it hits a lot of things. And we had to go back and look at chemicals. Some dyes actually have CF3 on them. Some dyes have a CF on them and it's mono. And so, right, the spirit of all this, why is a CF3 bad, is because they don't biodegrade. And even that's oversimplification, right? But like, not everything with the CF3 doesn't biodegrade, but that's the spirit of what they're trying to get to, right? Bioaccumulation and biodegradation. So in my mind, I don't know of any molecules with just one CF that bioaccumulate and biodegrade because of that one bond. Versus on the other side, yes, typically things with lots of CF2s and CF3s, it does affect their bioaccumulation and biodegradation.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, Jeff, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with all of us your experiences, your journey from a Netflix show to getting rid of PFAS at Milliken. Netflix should be aware of that. They'd be so proud of themselves. All right. And thanks to all of you who came on and shared your questions. But again, Jeff, huge thank you for joining us. And thanks to everyone who was able to come out today. Thanks so much.
Take care. My pleasure. Have a good rest of the day, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.